The book is The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser, Chapter the Eighth. It was high revelry and steamy debauch in the keelhauler's lounge, the big back room of the foundered Squid in the pirate hell of Libertatia. Here all that was gaudiest, bawdiest, and most abandoned in the pirate community gathered to riot nightly in the traditional fashion which you've seen scores of times, raffish ruffians staggering about with pint pots, their hairy arms round bedizened trulls, in big earrings and ragged off-the-shoulder finery, a wild gypsy wench with a tambourine dancing a fiery fandango on the table, while roaring bullies pound brawny fists in applause and discriminating diners hurriedly withdrew their plates from beneath her stamping heels. The air is blue with the fumes of fragrant sacerdotes' tobacco, the smoke of joints, and the reek of firebeard's whiskers. Drink and doubloons are scattered broadcast, drunks litter the floor, bursts of obscene song echo against blackened rafters. And all in all, it's absolute hell to stage, and even worse to clean up afterwards. In a side room, where only the thunder of celebration and pistol shots from without, and the occasional body crashing in from the main room disturbed their discussion, the five pirate chiefs sat in council. Days have passed since we saw them, abandoning Avery and Blood on the dead man's chest, and in the interval they had dispersed briefly to their private haunts to rest and tidy up before reconvening at the foundered Squid to plot their next villainy. As thus, Rackham, methodical as always, had parceled up his calicoes for the dry cleaners, checked the share prices, paid a subscription to NUPE, see page 104, and forwarded his piece of the Madagascar crown by registered post to his faithful paramour Anne Bonny on their shark-infested island retreat, with instructions to hold on to it carefully until he had made up his mind between the Mosquito Coast Building Society and the Harvest of the Seas Investment Trust, Cayman Islands Limited. Bilbo, in his decaying colonial mansion, had removed his beautiful cardigan boots with the help of Goliath the dwarf, sat wincing with his feet in cold water, worried about his falling hair and the absence of invitations to local social functions, and had his cross from the crown set in his rapier pommel. By good fortune it was the black pearl which matched his sable attire, and Bilbo was rather pleased with the effect, practising lunges in front of the mirror and crying, "Saha!" while Goliath stamped his little wooden leg in admiration. Firebeard, who had no home of his own, and would have forgotten where it was anyway, had stormed ashore bellowing at Libertatia, reduced a couple of taverns to matchwood, been fined for committing a public nuisance. He had assured the magistrate with hideous oaths that he thought he was in the gents, and how was he to know it was the dining room of the Libertatia Intercontinental, them pimpish places all looked alike anyway, by thunder, and lost his share of the crown, playing dice with Happy Dan Pugh, who had the advantage of being able to count. Happy Dan, with suave French chuckles, "Un, deux, trois, and sept on the autre cube makes a dix, mon pauvre baboon barbou, you lose again, eh bien, isn't it, but yes," swept in the takings while Firebeard punched holes in the wall and demanded a recount. "Ne tanglez-vous avec Happy Dan Pugh," chortled the lace-bedecked frog. "Not until vous avez learned to count, possibly à l'école de Monsieur Cladel, avec la craie, l'encre et le tableau noir." And he minced off in an aroma of ponce and civet down the street to deposit his own cross and Firebeard's at the establishment of Vladimir Mackintosh Grunbaum, pawnbroker and agent extraordinary to the filibusters of the settlement, of whom more anon, and ye may lay to that. Black Sheba, torn with longing for Avery, had looked in at the Goa slave market, bought a couple of muscular Swedish galley slaves on impulse, decided 5 minutes later that she didn't want them, and gone into a screaming passion when the market manager tactfully pointed out that they were at sale price and couldn't be exchanged, reducing Goa to a smoldering shambles and staking out the market committee for the giant crabs, had barely taken the edge off her temper, and she had retired in a sulk to her ghastly black castle, hung the Swedes up in chains with her other old things, and prowled the echoing stone corridors in a scarlet kimono with ermine trim, smoldering with desire for the English captain, before returning to Libertatia to have her hair done. Vanity had been quite wrong, you see. There was a perfectly good unisex salon with tinting, perming, blow waves, the lot, and a yoga class in the back. Sheba had had her cross. Note, just for the record, the crosses had been distributed as follows: Sheba Diamond, Bilbo Black Pearl, Happy Dan Pugh Opal, plus Firebeard Sapphire, both now at Uncle's, Rackham Ruby, Akbar Emerald, now in possession of T. Blood Renegade. Right? Fine. Sheba had had her cross converted into a necklace, and now as she presided at the pirate council it shone like a crystal of glittering fire on her tawny bosom, complementing the slinky white caftan number which she wore against the torpid evening heat. She sipped a daiquiri and applied gold polish to her nails as Rackham read the minutes, reported on the state of the roof at the filibuster's home of rest, noted the compensation awards to paid-up Brotherhood members wounded in recent actions, and proposed an interim dividend. All passed. Nem con, whereafter they proceeded to other business, i.e. deciding whom they would clobber next, just like any other board of directors, really. Various proposals were entertained. Happy Dan, with typical continental lewdness, was for establishing a chain of brothels and leisure centres with machines along the Coromandel coast, but it was agreed that the market was saturated already. Bilbo's plan for a descent on the plate fleet was greeted with groans, since it came up at every meeting, and was regarded as a last resort. Everyone knew that if successful it would just lead to a counterproductive rise in insurance premiums anyway. Firebeard, who was usually silent at these meetings, save for animal grunts and bellows, and had been moodily breaking bits off his end of the table, suddenly startled them with a proposal. "By the powers," he bawled, crunching his glass tween grinding teeth, "let's sack, plunder, and burn Tortuga, with a curse. 'Tis rich wi' booty, and there's females a-plenty for love and sport and hearty ravishment. Sink me if there bain't!" He was thinking of that big blonde barmaid at the Bucket of Blood, of course. "Aye, and a power o' moidras and chestfuls o' gems o' price. We can rip, tear, and rend it wholesale wi' hellish slaughter."
"It's our own headquarters, thou pestilent guts," cried Bilbo impatiently, and Firebeard scowled his mortification and muttered that nobody told him anything. "Peace!" snapped Black Sheba, and in an instant there was silence, as they eyed the sable beauty, lounging in her chair, toying with her jeweled cross, whose fiery gleam was not brighter than the fiendish light of cruelty in her amber eyes. Her smile was wicked, and her voice hissed like water in a hot frying pan, as she suddenly leaned forward voluptuously, a movement which caused Bilbo to swallow sharply, Happy Dan to drop his quizzing glass and exclaim, "Tout craqué!" and Firebeard to bite the table leg.
"Hear me, camarados," said the pirate queen. "These ploys be but small potatoes, scarce worthy the metal of such as we. Why, consider, with a treasure ta'en from Fort St. Bartlemy, with a British admiral cast adrift, and his organization in a worse state than China,
were our vast fleet, secure havens of Tortuga, Libertatia, and the coast, our crews of seasoned Tare dreadnoughts, are we not meet for an enterprise of scope and splendor to make the world ring and cause crowned heads to tremble at our power? She paused, and her gaze scorched them like a microwave oven.
Such as, said Rackham soberly, powerful fingers tapping his square chin.
Indeed, sweet sister, quo sardonic Bilbo, such exploit we had long dreamed on. But what, ha? Huh? If thou hast such a biggie in mind, then discourse, black beauty, discuss and elaborate.
Mais oui, I wait agog to hear of this caper formidable, cried Happy Dan. Je listen, me, and perpend, ain't it? Un coup énorme, sacré bleu, spille, chérie, tout suite.
Where's China? Growled Firebeard, who had got lost further back.
Black Sheba considered them neath sleepy lids. Of all the nations of earth, she murmured, which is our strongest, greatest foe, whose humblement in the west would most enrich us and enhance our might?
Spain, said Bilbo promptly.
The Dons, agreed Rackham, and Happy Dan nodded vigorously. Firebeard's agreement might be assumed from the fact that he hurled his chair against the wall, tore down a curtain, and yelled, "Them onion flogging, garlic guzzling, bull fighting, incense swinging dago bastards! I hate 'em! I despise 'em! I'll sink, split, tear, and cast anchor in 'em, so help me!" etc., etc.
Spain, indeed, purred Black Sheba. Now, could we obtain mastery o'er her empire in the Americas, then should the coast brethren be a power indeed, like to a government. We, the outlaws, the landless, could become a country, to treat with others, show a flag, dispatch envoys, sign accords, enter the Davis Cup, and enjoy rank as doth a nation state. And, if ever we get that far, she was thinking, the first thing I'll demand from the Brits is a free pardon, recognition as Queen of Libertatia, and to clinch my goodwill, they can lend me, as fleet commander, a certain gorgeous Apollo from the Royal Navy, assuming he got off that sandspit in one piece. If this sounds like pipe dreaming on Sheba's part, remember, she's had a tough time in life and may not be entirely free of toys in her attic. Her fellow captains gaped at her in amaze, and Rackham cleared his throat.
"It's one way of going legitimate," he said tactfully, "but, camarado, 'tis thing impossible. O'erthrow Spain i' the New World? You're kidding. Certes, we're strong and well-lined wi' gold, but you can't fight City Hall. Spain is First Division stuff."
"And ripe for the steel toe-cap," cried Sheba, her eyelashes snapping like whips. "Hear me while I unfold a plan whereby we may have the Dons of the Caribbean Empire running around like headless chickens and take over their whole operation."
Awed by her flashing eyes and hot gusts of her Nina Ricci perfume, those hardened ruffians waited for her to continue.
"According to the gossip column of the Goa Reminder," said Sheba, "the viceroy of the Spanish Indies, a bloated and evil reptile named Don Lardo Baluna del Lobby y Corridor, is affianced to the choicest bloom of the Spanish aristocracy, Donna Melliflua, etc., a sweet virginal child who was Deb of the Year at the Escurial Barbecue. I've seen her picture, and she's a Lulu, I have to admit," added Sheba grudgingly. "Howbeit, Don Lardo, being impatient for the nuptials..." Indignant cries interrupted her.
"Disgusting! The dirty old rip! Poor kid, it oughtn't to be allowed!"
And Firebeard smashed a chandelier in his righteous wrath.
"His child bride sails from Cadiz for Cartagena next month in an argosy of richness to match its precious cargo. Now,
Let us intercept that argosy as it nears the isthmus. Snatch the plump little pigeon for whom this vice-regal bladder is panting like a bellows, and we've got Don Lardo by the shorties, but good. Black Sheba's lips writhed in a hateful smile. What ransom, think you, will he give for her? I'll tell you. The plunder of Cartagena City will be our price, the surrender and disarming of its fleet and garrison, his own person in our hands, and then, her jeweled finger stabbed the table, then we break faith, cut his throat, overrun his province, and with the loot and armaments at our disposal, sweep on to Panama, Maracaibo, Campeche, Mexico City, Acapulco Beach, the whole works. Spanish America will be as a ripe fruit that ye squeeze, savor, and consume at your good pleasure. The slim fingers clenched into a fist, and Sheba licked her purple lips as though she could taste the juice. After that, who knows, today Panama, tomorrow... Firebeard went berserk and started stamping through the floorboards in a frenzy of exultation. Bilbo inhaled a full box of snuff in his excitement. Happy Dan danced the Carmagnole on the table, and Rackham gnawed his lip thoughtfully. This girl needs a good long rest in quiet surroundings, he was thinking. But while he regarded her imperial fantasies as so much elephant gravy, he saw sure profit in kidnapping Donna Mellifluwa and squeezing Don Lardo for an enormous ransom. "When sails the argosy, and on what course?" he asked, and Sheba shook her sleek head. "'Tis close-kept secret, that," said she. "Outside Madrid only Don Lardo himself is privy, so to Don Lardo we must apply." "As how, dusky goddess?" croaked Bilbo, between thunderous sneezes, and Sheba smiled silkily and toyed with her necklace. "Myself shall visit him, possibly in guise of Creole millionairess, or Lady Equality on her travels, or itinerant go-go dancer," she shrugged. "It boots not, so long as I get a chance to work on the lecherous creep. He'll sing to little Sheba, don't you worry." "It's risky, camarado," said Rackham. "If so be as ye was recognized, 'twould be hideous death by torture at the hands of the bloody Inquisition, look ye, with stakes and nails and—" "Puppy dog's tails," laughed Sheba, and clapped the big man on the shoulder. "Never fear, Calico. I'll not be recognized what time I sex his secrets out of the Spanish squirt, unless with luck I get the chance to question him in more amusing fashion." And at the tigerish expression which flitted across her lovely features, even Rackham felt an inward chill. "Sooner you than me, Don Lardo," he thought. Still, he insisted, she should not go alone. Bilbo should carry her to the Spanish Main in the Laughing Sandbag, and lurk in a secluded cove, while she, with Firebeard as a personal bodyguard, ventured into Cartagena in what guise might seem best to insinuate acquaintance with Don Lardo. In the meantime, Rackham and Happy Dan would await Akbar. Little they dreamed that Avery had turned the great corsair's toes up permanently, and follow with all their force to Tortuga, there to organize the pirate fleet, make do and mend, and catch up on their correspondence while they awaited word from Sheba of the argosy's date of sailing. So it was that on the dawn tide her crew hastily rounded up from the foundered Squid, the dockside Hells and Kennels, and the Libertatia Corporation Library. The sinister shape of the Laughing Sandbag weighed anchor and glided out of harbor through the pearly mist with sailorly cries of "Yo-ho!" and "Luff-a-lee!" and "All visitors ashore by the port gangway, hurry along, please." She near as a toucher ran down an exhausted figure dog-paddling toward shore in a manner which suggested that if it had been possible to swim on hands and knees, he would have been doing it. From the poop, the unfeeling Firebeard threw rocks at him with brutal cries of "har-har," never guessing who the swimmer was. we know, though, and the keener intelligences, which might have detected him, were both busy downstairs, Sheba going through her wardrobe to decide which outfit would most inflame Dunlardo, and Bilbo, with his cabin door locked, trying on a new hairpiece, bespoken from a mail-order firm under plain wrapper, while the dwarf Goliath stood by with scissors, adhesive, and helpful remarks. You will remember, a few pages back, we referred to the pawnbroking establishment of Vladimir Mackintosh Grunbaum, where Happy Dan Pugh had deposited his own piece of the Madagascar crown, as well as Firebeard's. This action had not been dictated by ordinary prudence, as has been noted. Happy Dan's destiny was entirely controlled by his obsession with Collins's French primer, and he carried in what passed for his mind a vivid picture of Le Voleur who lived dans la forêt, and who, Happy Dan was positive, were always lurking behind the next bush, waiting to hijack him. He had been much struck by Mr. H.M. Brock's lively illustration of them, brandishing their swords and pistols, and whenever valuables came into his possession, which in his profession they frequently did, nothing would do, but he must get them smartly under lock and key before Le Voleur of his board-duster-disturbed imagination could get their hands on them. Really, Happy Dan was a pretty sad case, and it was only his lifelong quest for La Jeune Fille avec la Grande Bouche, with whose picture, again by Brock, he had fallen passionately in love, that kept him going. Show him a Juno-esque brunette, and his eager greeting would be, Petite Pomme, only to have his hopes dashed when she failed to respond with Petite Poire. So, into Vladimir Mackintosh Grunbaum's safe had gone the two precious crosses, and it would be well to remark here, in case anyone thinks we are making racist jokes, that the pawnbroker's name was a fictitious one. Born Walter Puddifoot, he had decided on taking up his career, that you'd better sound like what you are, and that a new handle would be appropriate. Hence the happy blend of Caledonian Semitic, with a touch of old Mother Russia thrown in for good measure, and a Cockney accent to boot. The rest of the legend on his shop sign, by appointment turf accountant to Oliver Cromwell, was pure affectation. He never had been, really. But a smart man was Vladimir, and when, on opening up shop next morning, he received as his first customer a bedraggled individual with water leaking from his boots, seaweed in his hair, the airs of a gentleman and an Irish accent. He was intrigued. With this apparition offered for sale a gorgeous emerald set in a gold cross which bore evidence of having been hacked loose from some larger object of vertu, and which Vladimir recognized in a fraction of a millisecond as being fellow to the two crosses already in his possession, he was deeply interested and a mite alarmed. He fingered unshaven pudgy jowl, screwed up piggy eyes, wiped bulbous nose, and played for time.
Paste, of course, and you can see where the brass is showing through on the settin', he wheezed throatily as he weighed the glittering marvel in his hand. But not bad for a temptation. You say a fiver, or stretch a point and I'll make it a guineas.
Now it was not without qualms that Blood had so recklessly exposed his treasure for sale at the first hawk shop he had encountered on emerging dripping from the sea, but he was rendered desperate. If you'd swum 15 miles and had Firebeard hurling rocks at you, you'd have been anxious to cash it in yourself. But he'd been in pawn shops before and knew the drill.
"Try again, Izzy," said he. "Sure, 'tis a genuine emerald of vasty price, given to me by me old mother, Lady Bridget O'Hagan, a Marion Square, just round from the art galleries, and worth 20,000 if it's worth a penny."
In fact, it was worth 5 times that, but Blood was no expert and hungry into the bargain.
"I'll make 10,000, and if you don't like it, I'll be bidding you good day and be damned to you."
"My boy," exclaimed Vladimir, aghast. "My boy, be reasonable. I got 11 kids and a mortgage. Let's see now.
His greasy features contorted as in thought.
I can see you're a proper gent down on your luck, so I might stretch to 5,000, though I'd be risking a thumping loss.
His piggy eye flickered suspiciously at Blood and away again.
You wouldn't have any more of these on you, I don't suppose?
I would not, said Blood, suspicious in turn. Why?
Just wondered, Vladimir fluttered hastily. It looks like he's been chopped loose off or something, but maybe it's just wear and tear. Proper careless Lady Bridget or what's it must have been, if you don't mind my saying so. Tell you what, he went on, greasily confidential, why don't you take these 20 guineas as in advance, pop round to the Founded Squid, just mention my name, and get yourself a shave, clothes pressed, shoe shine, and a bite of breakfast, and I'll get this properly assayed and valued. I can see now it ain't paste. Dunno what's happening to my eyes these days, old age, I expect.
And he leered pathetically.
Lovely breakfast they do in the Squid cafeteria. Ham and eggs, grilled flying fish, turbot au gratin, hot coffee and toast, mango marmalade, the whole lot. And the chambermaids is a bit of all right and all, he added with a lewd wink.
Now Blood was hungry, and life had taught him to grab what was going, so he accepted the pawnbroker's guineas and hastened round to the Founded Squid and breakfast, leaving behind him an agitated Vladimir, hastily donning coat and wig. Happy Dan Pugh, in depositing the opal and sapphire crosses, had waxed descriptive, and Vladimir knew all about the Madagascar crown and its division among the pirate leaders. He knew also that whoever Blood was, he wasn't a member of the Brotherhood, and that his possession of a cross from the crown was something that any good sneak, grass, and narc, and Vladimir was all of those, could be well advised to bring to the attention of the brethren as quickly as possible. You didn't mess about with those babies, or conceal information, not if you valued your neck. With a cry to his lad to mind the shop, Vladimir was out and hurrying down the quay as fast as his little legs would carry him, bawling for a cockboat to carry him out to where the Grenouille Frenétique rowed lazily at anchor. If Blood had had his wits about him, he'd have noticed her as well as Rackham's brig, the Plymouth Corporation's Revenge. But our colonel could never tell one ship from another anyway, and it hadn't occurred to his feckless Irish mind that the pirates who'd taken the 12 apostles were likely to be swanning around Libertatia. So, all unconscious of his peril, our gallant colonel, replete with hot cakes, black puddings, and the advertised mango marmalade, presently repaired to the barber shop, where a pert octoroon wench in a frilly skirt installed him in a reclining chair, fluttered her eyelashes at him, covered him with hot towels, and was just murmuring in his ear about close shaves and Turkish baths, when the floor seemed to give way, and Blood was precipitated, chair and all, into a noisome cellar. Here in the fetid dark, invisible hands trussed him to the chair, his eyes were dazzled by smoky torch glare, and the emerald cross was thrust before his face.
"Where got ye this cully?" growled a menacing voice.
"Never saw it in my life," cried Blood instinctively. And then, his surroundings becoming vaguely visible, he was aware of swarthy bearded faces, hankies round brows, and an eye-patch or two, naked steel, leering expressions, and two figures foremost, one enormous in neatly pressed calico, the other in froggy frills and satin waistcoat. Our colonel considered.
"Mercy me! Though now I come to look at it, 'tis surely part of the Madagascar crown," he exclaimed. "Well, there's a coincidence, and surely," he feigned astonishment, "ye be two of the bully brotherhood with whom I was anxious to enlist. And are ye keeping the best, then? Faith, it's glad I am to see friendly faces."
"Save it," said Rackham, and took the colonel's throat in an iron grip. "And look ye, daw cock,
We ha hot coals for tween thy toes, knotted cords for thy brows, keen sliver of bamboo for neath thy fingernails, and jam sandwiches to bind in thy armpits, unless ye discourse right speedily. This cross was given to Akbar the Damned. Now, what of him? How hadst thou it? And where is the admiral's daughter and the king's man Avery? Whence come ye? And how the hell did you get off the dead man's chest anyway? Ye have 5 seconds, starting now.
Well, let's go upstairs and have coffee, suggested Blood. Or better still, the drinks are on me. All right, I'll talk.
Which he did, succinctly, and, since there was no point in lying, and the thought of jam butties in his armpits was too much to bear, accurately, whereon his captors swore in amaze, beliked, lookied, and invited the powers to rend, blast, and shiver him. Happy Dan Pugh was distraught.
Ah, but I am disconsolate, me. Le pauvre Akbar, we were like frere, and now he is mort. Ella and purple patches, and has gone to the grand salle de classe in the sky. Ah, but that Avery is gros stinker. He must have fought foul. The referee was bent. It is what you call a carve-up.
Nay, now, quo' Rackham, tapping shaven chin in narrow-eyed thought, this Avery is a canny lad, and white of skill and enterprise, and he proposes our downfall, doth he? Well, now, here's food for thought. And ye say he intends to bestow the admiral's daughter on the pleasant isle of Aves, eh? What time he ventures forth against us?
Oh, that's the place, agreed the recreant Blood, who had no shame. I heard him, plain as you like. Well, I'm glad you've got Akbar's cross back, so I am. It's been worrying me. A valuable thing like that, and not knowing where the lost property office was.
The pleasant Isle of Aves, Rackham was murmuring, and his teak-like clock softened in reminisce. Aye, I mind the verse, where we listened to the roar of breakers on the reef, outside that never touched the shore.
How does it go after that?
He closed his eyes. All day we fought like bulldogs, but they broke the booms at night.
Burst the booms at night, corrected the little Welsh pirate, who was a know-it-all.
Broke, blast your eyes, shouted Rackham. Burst, insisted the smug Taffy, and found himself swung bodily up by the shirt-front before Rackham's steely eyes. I say broke, said Rackham softly. So broke it is, ye psalm-singing Pontypool smart-ass, and ye may lay to that.
Have it your way, then, sulked the small Welshman. But it still burst, he added sotto voce, as Rackham tossed him aside and became again the resolute pirate skipper.
We must take order instant, said the big man. Happy Dan, you lay course for Aves straight, and pick up the doxy. She may be worth more as hostage than as slave. Then shall you join with Bilbo and Sheba at Cartagena, I'll to Tortuga, to prize the brotherhood that this Avery cull is on the loose, and like to work us mischief. He must be bloody Captain Marvel, he must, added Rackham, frowning, and his eye fell on the pinioned Blood, who was trying to look inconspicuous. Difficult, when you're trussed to a barber's chair in the middle of a gang of ruffians with guttering torches. As for this muckrake, continued Rackham, shout along with Happy Dan in irons, so that, if it be so, ye've lied to us, and Vanity Wench proves to be otherwhere than Aves, he may dispose of ye right painful and slow, and frog some tricks and torments. But at this his followers cried out,
Nay, Cap'n, let's grill him now, tasty-like. See, the brazier gleams white-hot, and it'd be a shame to waste the coal. And the knotted cords and all, and bamboo slivers. Why, Mike and Pegleg has spent 30 minutes sharpening 'em, and the jam sandwiches getting stale and curly at the crusts.
But Rackham was adamant, and ere night had fallen, the Grenouille Frenetique had weighed anchor for distant Aves, Happy Dan reclining on a daybed on the poop with a yellow-backed novel,
while his crew chattered excitedly and hoisted the sails in lubberly frog fashion, emotional tears streaming down their striped jerseys as the ship's orchestra played the Marseillaise and Dance in the Old-Fashioned Way, and in the perfume-drenched orlop, where even the bilge was by Chanel, Colonel Blood stirred restlessly in his chains and had a screaming visit from the ship's cook, who said that prisoners who sent back their frogs' legs and snails would get them warmed for breakfast, so there! Hard on the heels of the Frenchman, the Plymouth Corporation's Revenge stood out for Tortuga, and Libertatia was left to comparative tranquillity, which pleased the sober citizens, all three of them, but caused great discontent among the rest of the population of drabs, sharps, bawds, trulls, fences, pimps, cutpurses, licensed victuallers, innkeepers, swindlers, and dentists, all of whom agreed that at this rate it would be the lousiest season on record, with bookings down all round and vacancies signs in the windows of every hell and bawdy house. The chairman of the tourist board explained plaintively to a meeting of infuriated citizens that the cost of holiday fares to Madagascar was prohibitive, and they couldn't expect to attract union conferences while Port Royal had a better beach, at which the mob roared to the hangman to turn him off the ladder, and his tarred corpse swung in chains below high water mark for months thereafter. However, it was about a week after Rackham and Happy Dan Pugh had sailed that a skiff put in at the Libertatia Mole, and dockside idlers observed a tall, athletic figure dressed as a boucan hunter, his skin so bronzed that it might almost have been stained with walnut juice, his face hidden in the shadow of his broad-brimmed palm-leaf hat, step from the boat and stride up the mole with clean-limbed grace. You think it's Avery, but it's not. It's just another tall, athletic, but perfectly genuine boucan hunter. However, if you look over there, along the crowded waterfront street, you will see our gallant captain in person, threading his way with commanding agility through the crowds of hawkers, vendors, fruit peddlers, pedal fruiters, and their waterside riffraff. He pauses outside the premises of Vladimir McIntosh Grunbaum, and his keen, level gray eyes scan the advertisements pinned in the window. This must strike a discriminating reader as one beezer of a coincidence, and it is, the author's only excuse being that if Avery were to turn up in Reykjavik or Darwin, Australia, it would cause fearsome logistical problems and play absolute havoc with our plot. No, it has to be Libertatia, but you are entitled to know how and why he got there. Simple, really. Having woken in his boat to find that Blood had absconded with Akbar's cross, our hero had lost no time about setting his jaw in lines of firm resolve, clenching his perfectly formed teeth, making sure that there was some corned beef left under the cloth, setting a course for Aves, arriving there 2 days later by dint of masterly seamanship, peerless navigation, dead reckoning, and rowing like blazes from time to time, handing Vanity ashore, running her up the promised two-story bower, furnishing it and strewing its floor with fragrant herbs, stocking its larder with tropical fruits and fresh-caught fish, which he salted with sailorly skill, constructed her a bathing pool in the nearby stream, building a path to the lagoon, showing her how to load and fire a pistol, rearranging the furniture to her liking, dashing off a quick pencil sketch of himself, autographing it, to my adored mistress, biting his lip in doubt, doing another sketch and autographing it, to my adored dear one, soon to be officially betrothed, sticking it over the mantelpiece, pushing back a lock of hair which had fallen over his marble brow, and remarking, "Well, that'll do for the moment, I think. Like it, darling?" Vanity had clapped her hands with girlish pleasure and cried that it was top hole, and if he could just arrange on his return to warm the water for the bathing pool, it would be simply perfect. Avery, for the first time in their acquaintance, had drawn in his breath ever so slightly, but had assured her fondly that it would be his first concern when he got back no later than next Friday evening. Vanity had then shyly presented him with a kerchief which she had worked up from the gauze of her harem pants, and he had dropped on one knee, his eyes misting with nobility, pressed it to his lips, and said it would be his guerdon. She said, well, actually it was a sweat rag, and they came jolly useful on hot days, and whenever he wiped his brow or cleaned blood off his rapier, she hoped he would think of her. Thereafter they embraced on the edge of the golden sands, the creamy surf lapping at their ankles, the amber sun sinking beyond the turquoise ocean rim, parakeets shrilling midst the foliage, coconuts plumping from palms, mosquitoes buzzing in the mangrove, and the roof of the bower caving in where Avery had skimped a bit. Oh, it was real blue lagoon stuff, and when presently he shoved off in his frail craft, his last sight of her was the slim, golden-headed figure on the headland, waving a palm leaf in farewell, or beating off the midges, he wasn't sure which. He laid course for Libertatia because, A, it was where blood had been making for, and it seemed a sound move to repossess himself of Akbar's cross to start with, and B, it was the most likely place to recruit the kind of following which reflection told him he was going to need. In the intervals of building Vanity's bower, furnishing it, strewing fragrant herbs, etc., the captain's razor-keen mind had been busy as thus. If I'm going to scupper this coast brotherhood, 'twere well to furnish myself with vessel more commodious than this rather inferior rowing boat, something with 3 masts, 100 guns, and a sizable crew for choice. Right. But since through fell mischance I am the whiles without the law, and old Rook will have reward notices in every shipping office by this time, it'll have to be a rented job, and not at a civilized port either. Libertatia is about as uncivilized as you can get. So ho for it. So now you see why he's pressing his aristocratic nose against Vladimir's window, studying the want ads. Stately Spanish galleon XKE, 1668, one owner, 50,000 leagues, authentic shot scars, gilded coachwork, offers over 2 chests moidores. Experienced buccaneer, voyages Morgan, Montbars, Lullanois, willing exchange Corsair or Coromandel slaver, references, please. Lost, plate fleet, missing off Florida Keys since July. Answers, names, Santissima Trinidad, Concepcion, Maria Gloriosa, etc. Contact owner in confidence, Philip R., Escurial, Madrid, or P.O. Box Cartagena, reward. And one real tear-jerker. Galley slave, slightly scarred, experienced Barbary, Adriatic, seeks new interests, anything considered. Avery shook his handsome head, went inside, and called, "Shop ho within!" Vladimir's reaction to this godlike visitor was much what Mr. Pepys's had been. You ought to be in pictures, boy, but who'd model for the BOP covers while you were away? Awe and a sense of his own worm-like unworthiness abashed the little shyster, and when Avery demanded a well-found second-hand man-o'-war, crewed by 200 seasoned desperate fellows, he assumed his most ingratiating smirk.
"Cash or check, sir?"
Avery hesitated. Strapped for the ready, he yet scorned to mislead this honest tradesman. "Neither, Master Pawnbroker," he replied frankly. "I pledge mine honour to make full payment after my mission is accomplished."
"Quite, quite, yes."
Vladimir scratched dubious, unshaven chin. Only respect for the captain's muscular size and some strange instinct prevented him from giving this proposal the horse laugh it deserved.
"Might I humbly inquire what your honour's mission might be? Just for me own confidential files, like?"
"To extirpate utterly," replied Avery crisply, "and to sweep from the seas, as ye might blow froth from a pint, that vile fellowship who do style themselves Brethren o' the Coast."
"I see,"
Vladimir restrained an urge to call for 4 strong men and a canvas jacket.
"The Coast Brotherhood, eh? Just so, ah. Would your lordship be a private gentleman, or was you representing a firm?
A firm, fellow. Disgust and disdain competed for space on Avery's mobile lips. Do you take me for huckster or base commercial monger, I?
Not for a minute, cried Vladimir, fawning. I see you was a tough first go. It's just without collateral and references. I mean, I'd advance her a man of war myself, no sweat, if I had one handy. But as it is, I'd have to shop around, and times being what they are, even the co-op is asking cash on the nail. I dunno.
He scratched his matted locks, wondering why he should feel vaguely sympathetic to this superb loony.
I'm afraid you're going to have problems.
But hang it all, expostulated Avery. How do chaps get ships, then? Chaps without oodles of oof, I mean.
Well, Vladimir considered, I have heard of people pinching 'em.
Seeing Avery stiffen indignantly, he added quickly,
I mean, 'tain't really pinching if it's a foreign ship, is it? No? Well, he considered again, I don't suppose you feel like shipping on a king's vessel and starting a mutiny? No, I thought not. Or if I was to steer you to a rich widow with a merchant fleet. I mean, one look at you and the old bag'll fall all over herself. Sorry, just thinking aloud. Let's see, difficult. Of course, if you was a plantation slave, unjustly condemned and toiling under the lash in the tropic sun, you'd be laughing. Just wait for a pirate attack, lead a slave uprising, save the settlement, collar a vessel, and Bob's your uncle. Takes time to organize, though, and I suspect you're in a hurry.
Vladimir sighed, contemplated his slightly crestfallen visitor, and of a sudden his beady eyes squinted and his jaw dropped.
Here, he exclaimed, ain't I seen you afore somewheres? Surely, that fearless baron, eagle eye and perfectly creased profile, that clean-limbed youthful grace blended with the air of one born to command, them faultlessly manicured nails.
Avery sighed impatiently. Not again, he thought. Naval officers, he said coldly, do not give autographs. You may write to the Admiralty for a picture, enclosing postage.
That's it, cried Vladimir. Naval officer, you're him. You're Long Ben Avery, beg pardon. Captain Benjamin Avery, R.N. I've seen you in the papers.
He pawed at the rubbish on his counter and produced a crumpled broadsheet.
See, there's a woodcut in column one, but it don't do your honour justice if I make so bold. Well, I never.
But Avery had plucked the sheet from his hand. It was the Daily Looky, Libertatia's leading quality journal, and our hero's face set pale as drying emulsion paint as he scanned the glaring headlines. 12 Apostles ta'en, Black Sheba rescued as Brotherhood score again, Vasty Booty, Admiral Adrift, King's Captain turns Fink, Traitor, by our staff writers. Avery's head swam, and he could not repress a ruptured squawk as he conned the lead paragraph. Buccaneering and official naval circles were rocked from truck to keelson last week by the dastardly defection. There it was, the lying tale of his supposed betrayal, the loss of the crown, vanity's abduction, the breakfast menu for the fatal day, but not a word of his own defiance when they fed him to the sharks.
I knowed he was yeller first time I clapped deadlights on him,
Captain Firebeard told our reporter, a fictitious interview with Rook headed, What Have They Done With My Baby? Pleads Panic Dad, an advertisement for a forthcoming series entitled My Captivity Capers with King Charlie, Black Sheba Tells All, a lurid account of the fate awaiting vanity in the slave mart, and a letter protesting at the import of whitey tarts into Muslim seraglios and demanding a quota, signed Disgusted Concubine Baghdad.
It's in a populars and all.
Vladimir was holding up a tattered tabloid with the enormous banner Rooked, and a front-page opinion column headed Har-Har.
There was a full frontal of that Sheba in the star troll spot on page 3, sighed Vladimir. Core. But some bleeder tore it out, he added bitterly. His little eyes peered at the captain shrewdly. But this stuff about you turning traitor, it's a load of cobblers, isn't it, Your Honor?
Cobblers, sirrah? Avery shrugged as he dropped the broadsheet. The public appetite ever did prefer decked gaudy falsehood to plain sober truth.
I thought as much. Vladimir slapped the broadsheet with sweaty palm. Talk about propaganda. These ruddy rags are worse than Pravda. I knew it must be bleeding lies about you betraying this Madagascar crown thing. Course it is. You wouldn't stoop to nothing like that, not you.
His porcine peepers shone with fawning reverence.
Not death to the Dutch Avery, voted most promising hero of the year, winner of the Hornblower Award for Dago bashing. Oh, yes, sir, I've been following your career for years.
Avery was touched by the greaseball's admiration. Alas, my insanitary friend, thy good opinion shall not mend my credit.
It wouldn't need to, would it? Not if you cleaned up this perishing brotherhood. That's what you're going to do, ain't it?
Suddenly, the eager note in Vladimir's voice changed to pure camay. His jowls bristled cunningly.
No problem to you, Captain. You do it standing on your head. Core, the Admiralty wouldn't daft to be chuff. Never mind the King of Spain. Never mind credit. There'd be big rewards for you, I dare say. Honours and gravy and...
Tush! Bagatelles are no import, flicked Avery. My present need is ship and crew to smite these villains and recover the Madagascar crown.
That's right, cried Vladimir,
eyes agleam with the light of pure cupidity, as startling visions of profit revolved in his unkempt head. The moment he had realized who Avery was, something had told him that opportunity was not merely knocking, it was battering the door down. For here, in the shape of this splendid specimen, was a winner, if ever Vladimir had seen one. True, the coast brethren were a profitable connection, as well as being a bunch with whom it was perilous to monkey. But where would the brethren be when this human dynamo had finished with them?
Up the crick, down the stank, that was where.
And Avery, he'd be on top of the heap.
So?
That's right, repeated Vladimir, licking blubbery lips.
And when you get this crown back,
he omitted to mention that three of its crosses were in his safe at that minute,
you'll collect a power of prize money on it, to say nothing of all the other ill-got loot the brotherhood has stowed away. I mean, the government would have to give you a percentage, but I'm keeping you standing, my boy. Honoured sir, that is. Pray be seated and tell me something. Have you got an agent?
Avery smiled in puzzlement, and the oily knave explained.
You know, like a manager. Someone to take care of the office work and business details for a modest commission. You haven't? Oh, but you'd need one, you really would. See, if you're going after these pirate bleeders off your own hook, you'd have to do it by sort of turning pirate yourself, wouldn't you? Very respectable pirate, of course. Sort of privateer-like.
You may be right, conceded Avery. What then?
My boy, crooned Vladimir earnestly. Have you any notion what it costs? I mean, the overheads on a pirate ship is chronic. There's the mortgage, and interest, and victualling, and powder, and shot, and ship's tackle, and you haven't even got to the bloody crew yet.
I thought they were on piecework, said Avery.
And what about third-party cover, and their stamps, and sickness benefit? You want to see what them parishes get for the loss of a leg, for instance. You wouldn't believe it.
Vladimir waved grimy paws.
All them hop-alongs on the waterfront, like Long John Silver, somebody's paying for that, you know. It'd break your heart. One broadside, off goes the pin. Arm sore, stricken, cap'n. Next you know, the bugger's running a pub on the insurance. You gotta have corporate funding, I'll tell you that.
Avery was sore amazed. He'd had no idea.
And there's bribes for port officials, and the license fees is crippling. I could name you well-established filibusters who'd had to take half their ships off the water, never mind the running costs. And, of course, if you'll get a strike, that's it, and wrap up. It was strikes knackered sharp and kid, you know. Even Henry Bleeding Morgan, halfway back from Panama with a ruddy fortune, and the idle bastard sat down on him, straight up. If he hadn't been an ex-shop steward himself, and Welsh at that, he'd never have got back to Chagre. Oh, it's a business, I tell you.
That is outrageous. Avery, a practical man who had supposed it was a simple matter of yo-ho-ho and lay on my hearties, was appalled. Why isn't something done about it?
Well, that's where agents come in, quo crafty Vladimir. Take the Brotherhood. They got more managers and accountants than flaming gunners they have. You want to see their publicity budget and all? Well, Escamelin don't come cheap, does he? Cost you a governor's ransom afore he sets pen to parchment, but money's the least of it. It's the paperwork. You can't cope with that and expect to be shooting away spars and laying alongside and blowing dons to hell at the same time, can you? But with a good agent, nah, a class man who wouldn't ask more than 90%, and well worth it, why, you can concentrate on the essentials, can't you?
Avery had a sudden inspiration. Listening to this honest fellow, it had come to him, and while he was accustomed to being dazzled by his own genius, he had to admit that this time he'd excelled himself. He glanced down at the vulpine, greasy face leering up innocently at him. What time Vladimir washed his grubby paws in air and smiled to think how this simple shopkeeper had unwittingly pointed the way. "Master Mackintosh Grunbaum," said he, "it is in mind to appoint thee my agent. 90%, you said?" Vladimir's rat-like eyes opened wide. He gaped and caught at the table for support.
"Oh, sir," he quavered. "Oh, I never. You mean me? Well, but I'm all took aback."
He gazed at the smiling cabin with shark-like devotion.
"Sir, I am most deeply honored. No kid. Nah, I wonder if I have such a thing as a contract anywheres. Here, just you glance through these back numbers of Play Wench while I go and see."
It's a moot point whether Vladimir is listed as an accredited agent in the filibuster's yearbook, but although Avery little dreams it, the pawnbroker's possession of 3 of the crosses could have our hero's work for him, if Vladimir is to be trusted. Ha! And other perils and horrors lie ahead. There's vanity stuck on Aves, defenseless, with Happy Dan Pugh and his cutthroats closing in, and Black Sheba and Bilbo preparing to work their hellish design against Don Lardo. Who cares? And sweet Donna Mellifluwa, that's something else. Hurry, Avery, hurry.